Okay, good evening to everyone. I apologize for being a little hoarse tonight. This is part 12 of The Law and the Law, sponsored as always by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'il Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib. Tonight we're discussing the District of Columbia versus Heller and the Torah's view of gun control. Among the never-ending controversies in American life is the issue of gun control, and especially the power of government to limit private ownership of weapons. It's a very emotional area for some, touching on the elemental right of self-defense. And mindful that the first measure of fledgling dictatorships is usually the banning of private ownership of weapons. Now, one of the first things the Nazis did was confiscate all guns from Jews. The issue in America reflects stark regional differences, with the coasts largely supportive of gun control, which is really a ban on private ownership, or onerous regulation that makes private ownership very difficult to enjoy. That's the coasts. And the great heartland of America is largely antagonistic to any restrictions, on gun ownership. They'd give machine guns to three-year-olds if they could. It involves major interests and lobbying groups on both sides, including the NRA, which is probably the most successful lobby in America, and it evokes consistent misinformation, sometimes almost laughable misinformation. As recently as 2 weeks ago, you may have read that after a shootout in New York City, in which several police officers were injured, Mayor Bloomberg called for increased gun control. Of course, the guns used by the criminal were illegal, not legal, so any additional law would have not mattered at all. In fact, it's one of the great non sequiturs of American life. Whenever there's a crime involving an illegal weapon, some politician calls for increased regulation of legal weapons. That is to say, we can better protect ourselves against criminals by taking away guns from the good people. What's the connection? None. But it gives somebody something to say when silence would be more appropriate. At issue are these words from the second of the Bill of Rights, to some very clear, to others ambiguous, to everyone a lynching of standard grammar. And that's the Second Amendment to the Constitution. If I was technically creative, I would have a PowerPoint now with the Second Amendment posted right here, so you can follow how it's hard to understand. I'll try to explain it with the punctuation. This is the Second Amendment of the Constitution. A well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed. What's missing, which would have made it completely clear, is if there was the word and, A-N-D, before that last clause, the right of the people, and the right of the people. Otherwise, it's stated as three separate clauses, but meaning what? Again, a well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed. So does the law apply in the absence of a militia, or only in the context of a militia? If the latter, then why the phrase, the right of the people to keep and bear arms? The people imply more than just the militia. Or perhaps it's both. A militia can bear arms in order to ensure the security of the state, and people can bear arms as well to protect them from the potential tyranny of the state. Obviously, context is crucial, and it was the various state militias that eventually formed the nucleus of the American Revolution and the Continental Army itself. The right to bear arms, of course, was considered a natural right at common law, both in terms of self-defense from home invasion or random street attack, and protection from a hostile, despotic government. It was a natural right in medieval times, and through much of American history, colonial and after independence. In fact, during the Constitutional Convention, the right to bear arms was considered obvious. and unworthy of special mention. There was a time in the 19th century people would carry weapons into the White House even, because most people carried a weapon of one sort or another. Those who perceive the rights of the militia and the rights of the people as two separate rights have compelling grounds on which to rely. Interestingly, Madison's first draft of the Second Amendment sent to Congress in 1789 read, I quote, "The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed," semicolon. "A well-armed and well-regulated militia being the best security of a free country, but no person religiously scrupulous of bearing arms shall be compelled to render military service in person." So there you have a clear statement on Madison's part that the right of the people to bear arms shall not be, infringed. Obviously, it was sent to a committee. A committee always mangles everything it does. Too many people got involved, and the grammar got mangled as well. But in Madison's formulation, the semicolon after the first clause, and it is the first clause, marks it off from the rest. So clearly, there were two separate interests, not to have a federal army encroach on the state militias, and not to have the federal government encroach on the individual right to bear arms. Now, I note that in one formulation, Pennsylvania's suggestion, they wanted weapons limited only to militias and not at all to the individual, but that was never even brought to a vote. So what changed? Over time, the debate became whether the Second Amendment heralded a collective right or an individual right, or both, and that's where we are today. Each phrase in the Second Amendment was darshaned by their respective interest groups in order to bolster their opinions. What is undeniable is how the Second Amendment was understood by both the drafters and the society that embraced it, and this became the fundamental issue, partly resolved more than two centuries later by the court in District of Columbia versus Heller. Now, D.C. versus Heller was premeditated litigation. By that I mean it was the result of years of planning, waiting for the right set of plaintiffs and the right Supreme Court makeup to try to bring finality or at least clarity to one vexing issue that dates back to 1791. It was really not discussed that much by the court. What exactly does the Bill of Rights of the United States Constitution say about the private ownership of weapons? Surprisingly, it was unclear. It was clear lemaisa, but in theory, it was not clear. Well, the court didn't really bring finality, because it's still an issue, but they did bring some clarity to it. There were several cases that were consolidated, you know, the people, the interest groups involved, got good cases together, people who had to fight off rapists or burglars. The several cases were consolidated to adjudicate this matter. Many were dismissed for lack of standing of the plaintiffs. One case stood, and that's the case of Dick Anthony Heller. Heller was a special police officer in the District of Columbia, licensed to carry a weapon on the job in the federal buildings. He applied for a permit to possess a weapon in his home. Under the Firearms Control Regulations Act of 1975. Remember that D.C. is governed by Congress, it's not a state. Private home ownership of weapons in D.C. was prohibited. Heller's permit request was denied, and he, together with the NRA, the National Rifle Association, sued. The federal district court in D.C. ruled that the Second Amendment applies only to militias, like the National Guard, and not at all to private ownership of weapons. Accordingly, the court held that a jurisdiction has the right to control, limit, and even ban private ownership of weapons. But this ruling was only the first shot fired, pardon the pun. In the second round, the circuit court reversed and ruled 2-1 that the Second Amendment does protect private gun ownership, and the case was appealed to the Supremes. On June 28, 2008, just 4 years ago, the decision was handed down, typical 5-4 decision like we've become accustomed to, in a lineup very familiar to lawyers in the last few years. The conservative majority of Roberts, Scalia, Thomas, Alito and Kennedy ruled that the Constitution protects an individual's right, to possess a firearm for lawful purposes, such as self-defense in the home. Now, the arguments in the case almost immediately centered on the ambiguous language, almost exclusively. There's some talk about whether it applied to the district or it's not a state, but forget about that. Walter Dellinger, who was the Solicitor General under President Clinton, a very liberal law professor at Duke, argued, like the district court had, that the amendment was limited to militias, some state entity. Chief Justice Roberts, this is just less than a minute into the argument, said to him, if you're right, it's certainly an odd way to phrase the operative provision, both referring to militias and the right of the people. Roberts, if it's limited to state militias, why would they say the right of the people? Why not just say state militias have the right to keep arms? Dellinger argued that it meant the same thing, the people are the militia, to which Roberts responded that if so, then there are no limits at all, because the militia is the people, and the people are the militia. Any person can be part of the militia, and so it went. Justice Scalia noted that the two phrases work together perfectly. You'll see, he wrote the decision, and he wrote it with a real Gemara cup. He said, if you look at the statement again, the amendment, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms should not be infringed, Scalia said that the two phrases work together. The framers knew that the way militias were destroyed by tyrants was not by banning militias, but by taking away the people's weapons. So therefore, since we need a militia, the people's right to bear arms shall not be infringed. So Scalia, in fact, wrote the decision. He cited the restrictions in the District of Columbia. They made it illegal to carry an unregistered handgun. There was a need for a license to carry a handgun that was issued by the chief of police for 1 year periods. We had to go back every year, which if they granted a license required you to store the gun unloaded and with a special lock, except in a place of business. So the lock prevented its functional use in the home, and licenses were not frequently granted. The lock they had in mind, if, God forbid, there was a home invasion, by the time you got the lock off, you're dead. Scalia acknowledged the wholly different readings of the Second Amendment, but prefaced his opinion with the general precedent from 1824, I quote, that the Constitution was written to be understood by the voters. Its words and phrases were used in the normal and ordinary as distinguished from technical meaning. So Scalia wrote that, I quote, the Second Amendment is naturally divided into two parts, its prefatory clause and its operative clause. You could file this under Midos Shat Constitution Dreshes Vahed. There's a prefatory clause and an operative clause. The former does not limit the latter grammatically, but rather announces a purpose. The amendment could be rephrased. Because a well-regulated militia is necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Makes sense? And Scalia continued, logic demands that there be a link between the stated purpose and the command. I should note, in dissent, the dissenters disagree that that's the reading of their own reading. Scalia noted that the two other times in which the phrase right of the people is used in the Bill of Rights, it refers unambiguously to individual rights, the right of assembly, the right against search and seizure, not talking about a collective, but individuals. Elsewhere, where the Constitution refers to people, it means people, individual, not collective rights, and the individual, and not one who is part of some corporate entity. People means all members of the political community. And what does keep and bear arms mean? Now, again, the dissent would argue that that's a military term. The authorities bear arms. The point, though, that was made here is that that might be true, but not keep arms. Keep arms is a civilian reference and is never used in a military context. So Scalia wrote, that it means more than military. It means to keep weapons, means to have weapons. This to rebut what the minority held, that the right to bear arms is only in the context of the militia. I continue with his decision. Putting all of these textual elements together, we find that they guarantee the individual right to possess and carry weapons in case of confrontation. This meaning is strongly confirmed by the historical background of the Second Amendment. We look to this because it has always been widely understood that the Second Amendment, like the First and Fourth Amendments, codified a pre-existing right. That means it's not as if the Constitution created a new right for us. Rather, it just referred to and cited a pre-existing right of common law to keep and bear arms. I continue. The very text of the Second Amendment implicitly recognizes the pre-existence of the right and declares only that it shall not be infringed, meaning the right exists. Government may not infringe that right. As we said in United States versus Cruikshank, this is not a right granted by the Constitution, neither is it in any manner dependent upon an instrument for its existence. The Second Amendment declares that it shall not be infringed. Now, Cruikshank, the case that he cited, is a very interesting case in the late 1800s, in context, because the court in the infamous Dred Scott decision that justified slavery in the late 1850s, discussed that a few months ago, the court in Dred Scott said that blacks could not be citizens because, this is from the decision of Roger Taney, if they were citizens, then they would have the right to bear arms as whites do, and that can't be. In Cruikshank, a white mob attacked blacks. Several hundred blacks were killed. The mob was indicted for violating the civil rights of the blacks, and their convictions were overturned as the court here refused to apply the Bill of Rights to the states as it later would. Now, note the phrase shall not be infringed. Should not be infringed does not mean there can't be any limits. There could be some limits, as there are in other rights in the Bill of Rights, like of speech and assembly. We do not read, I quote, the Second Amendment to protect the right of citizens to carry arms for any sort of confrontation, just as we do not read the First Amendment to protect the right of citizens to speak for any purpose. Thus, there could be restrictions on people, felons, the mentally ill, places, schools, government buildings, etc. That will be no contradiction to the Second Amendment. In short, the D.C. law effectively banned self-defense in the home, and therefore Scalia wrote, we hold that the district's ban on handgun possession in the home violates the Second Amendment, as does its prohibition against rendering any lawful firearm in the home operable for the purpose of immediate self-defense. Now, of course, there's dissent, the foreign dissent, or Ginsburg, Breyer, Souter, and Stevens. You just take out Souter and Stevens now, put in Sotomayor and Kagan, and basically you have the same lineup today. Stevens wrote the primary dissent, emphasizing the Second Amendment's focus on the militia, and Stevens held that the framers had in mind only a military application, that had it meant an individual right, it would have stated clearly, and that nothing in the amendment makes reference to either hunting or personal self-defense. Stevens relied heavily on the one case that had dealt with the issue before, United States versus Miller, in 1939, in which Congress enacted legislation banning some sawed-off shotguns, implying that, and Stevens had implied, any weapon could be banned. But the fact that Scalia cited the same case to support his contentions. But one can easily distinguish between such sawed-off shotguns, or even machine guns, that generally have no civilian use. Justice Breyer also dissented, analogizing the D.C. ban to any public safety measure that a jurisdiction can have. Well, in the aftermath, the Second Amendment, after 190 years or so, after almost 210 years, gained a key definition by one vote. So the matter is still debated. It really hangs by a thread, as all these 5-4 decisions do. Dick Heller himself was not entirely successful in gaining his weapon for home use, after the case, D.C. passed a number of zoning regulations banning guns. They may ban bottom-loading semi-automatic weapons similar to machine guns, presumably permitting revolvers, but who knows? And then, as we all know, even in New Jersey, all these things are subject to the whim and discretion and arbitrariness of the police. Soon after Heller, several challenges were mounted across the country against a variety of local limitations on handgun ownership. In a major expansion, the court in 2010 expanded Heller to the states. Remember, the D.C. is just it's a federal enclave. In McDonald versus Chicago, the court ruled 5-4 that the Second Amendment applies to the states through the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, that Chicago's ban on the registration of handguns was unconstitutional. Truth is, the area is still in flux. Challenges remain both to gun control legislation that both allow and limit. Opinions vary, but as we know, so do facts, sad to say. Much is made in some quarters of gun accidents at home that kill, even though bathtubs and kitchen appliances kill far more. That's just the reality. One famous researcher, John Lott, have you heard of him? He's very controversial because his findings, he wrote a book a few years ago called More Guns, Less Crime. His research showed that states with concealed carry permits, meaning allowing people to carry guns concealed on the streets, those states generally have substantially lower street crime. And the fear of bar fights or anger killings, etc., have never materialized. You could track the matter. It's clear that states that sharply limit gun ownership, think New York, New Jersey, Illinois, etc., have very high crime rates. And states that have very liberal gun ownership, think Texas, have very low crime rates. Why? Because the criminal has to fear that his potential victim, male or female, might be armed. They're less likely to break into a home, less likely to attack someone on the street if the fear is that they're armed. It turns out that the old NRA bumper sticker is essentially true. When guns are outlawed, only outlaws will have guns. Crime increases when there are fewer legal weapons, because the only people with weapons, aside from law enforcement, are the bad guys. Put guns in the hands of the good guys, and crime goes down, way down. So why isn't that argument persuasive? Two reasons. One is the propaganda about danger and accidents and wrongful shootings, and a culture of dependence on law enforcement that the government cultivates. And secondly, a reluctance by government to ever relinquish its primary monopoly, which is power. Private handgun ownership is largely protected. It's still very difficult to obtain in many areas, but as for now, it depends on one vote on the Supreme Court. By no means is the debate over. So what does the Torah have to say about all this? From one perspective, the answer is clear. In theory, if the Melech wanted to ban guns or weapons, he could. He's the king. From a second perspective, the interest of the Second Amendment advocates in the right of gun ownership in order to facilitate hunting, which always here, is completely lost on Torah Jews. Hunting, that is, killing animals for sport, is considered a trait or a vocation of Nimrod or of Esav. There's no activity that's more remote to a Jewish sensibility than is hunting. From a third perspective, weapons are part of Jewish life, and it's dishonest to pretend that they're not. That, in fact, is one of the legacies of the exile. The Torah says, Lo yekla gever alisha, a woman cannot wear male garb. The Targum interprets that to mean, Lo yehi tikun zayn digvar al itso, that a woman cannot carry the weapons of men. That's the Isser. The Chizkuni writes, by the way, that's why Yoel Eshes Chevrakeni used a peg to kill Sisera and not a sword or a spear or a semi-automatic weapon, because those are clay, Zion of men. She used a peg. Rabbeinu Bachya writes there, Mona hakosuv klei zaymin orisha kadei shelo teitzela milchamov yesibalaznus. The Torah precluded women from carrying weapons, so women should not go into the army, should not fight wars, and be a reason for a cause of promiscuity. So the Torah prohibited women from carrying arms. This is based on the Gemara Nozir, Daf Nun Tesam at Aleph, Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Minayin, Shalot Haisa Isha B'Chleizai L'Milchama. How do you know women should not carry weapons to battle? Talmud Lomar, Lo Yekla Gever Al Isha, V'Lo Yabash Gever Simlas Isha, so a man can't dress up like a woman as well. But the implication, of course, is that weapons are pretty standard for men. This is also borne out by the Mishnah and Shabbos, Daf Samach Gimel Amud Aleph, referring to carrying on Shabbos. The Mishnah says, Lo Yetzeho Ish, man cannot go out in the public domain, it's just a rabbi on Shabbos, Lo Besayif, not with his sword, Lo Bekeshes, with a bow, Lo Betris, with a shield, Lo Beolo, and Ola is a club, Lo Beromach, with a spear, if he does go out, chayav chatos, no problem during the week. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, tachshitin hang low. Rabbi Eliezer said that weapons are ornaments for men. He said they can go out, and the tachshit is something that has a functional, even a decorative use. At least the sword, which is worn. The others, some Rishonim say, even he said you can't, because the others, like the bow, a spear you carry in your hand, but a sword that's worn, so that's a tachshit for a man. The Chachamim Omer, Chachamim said, explaining the first view, that no, weapons are not tachshitin ornaments, rather, einon ela l'kanai, they're actually a disgrace. Weapons. Shenemar, famous pasuk. It's on the wall at the UN. The chitisucha rasam liitin, the chanita tehemu mazmerot, that in the future, swords will be turned into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks. Lisa goy cherev, lo yilu, nation will not lift sword against nation, will make war anymore. And the war continues that in messianic times, weapons will be unnecessary, even as nai, even as adornment to one's clothing. Well, the Gemara is another version of this discussion. Rabbi Eliezer is understood to mean that one can carry these on Shabbos because weapons will always be tachshitin, even in the Messianic era, based on the pasuk in Tehillim Mem Hey, Chagor Charbecha Al Yorech Gibor, Hodcha V'Hadarecha, gird your sword on your thigh, mighty one. It is your majesty and glory. That, the Gemara says, is Rabbi Eliezer's source, that it's a tachshit for a man. It's Hodcha V'Hadarecha, it's your majesty and your glory. In effect, you see from Rabbi Eliezer, the Chachamim, there's two ways of understanding the Jewish approach to weapons. One has a necessary evil in these times, but that one that will be ultimately repudiated when the world is at peace. And secondly, as an adornment for man, even in messianic times. So why would it be an adornment? Should note the Gemara entertains that the verse Chagor Charbecha Al Yorech Gibor refers to the wars of Torah, which is true, meaning the Mechamta Shel Torah and Talmud Torah, but then concludes, Ein Mikra Yotze Medei Pshuto, the simple pshat is also true, and it refers to weapons. So why would it be an adornment for a man to carry a weapon? Well, we can speculate, women will for sure, about male pride, about male aggression, etc. But I think it comes down to one fundamental Torah principle, which informs our entire perspective on these matters. And that's the primacy of self-defense. The Torah value of Imbar Lahargecha Hashem Lahargo. If someone comes to kill you, you rise up and kill them first. The Tanhuma traces this to one of our wars in the Midbar. Rabbi Abachya cites it. Sororas Hamidjanim Kitzorim Heim Lachem. Attack, torment the Midianites because they attacked you. Mikan Omer Chazal Habola Hargecha Hashkem Lahargo. In fact, many of the Mefarshim justify the brother's sale of Yosef on grounds of Habola Hargecha Hashkem Lahargo. They thought Yosef was out to kill them. This principle is found several times in Shas in one form or another, in Brachos Daf Nun Chesam at Aleph, in Samach Beis Amud Beis, in terms of Rodev generally, and most famously, Yoma, but the real case is in Sanhedrin, the Ayin Beis on Aleph. We find the classic case of the Baba Machteres, the burglar who breaks into your home, whose life is forfeit. The Torah says you can kill him, Amarava. My time at the Machteret, why do we permit the homeowner to kill the burglar? Chazoko eino demaimin aksmo al mamono. Rava said it's presumed that no one is simply going to allow his property to be taken against his will. Now, as we know, this contradicts New Jersey law, where you're not allowed to kill a burglar who comes only to steal property. Mar says, no, chazaka eino demaimin atzma mamono. No one's going to just let his property be taken. V'hai meimar omar, this burglar reasons that, iazilna, if I enter, koila pai v'lo shavikli. He'll challenge me, he's not going to allow me to steal. V'koila pai, if he challenges me, ketilna way, I will have to kill him. That's the reasoning of the burglar. V'atorah omran, the Torah says, someone comes to kill you, you think someone comes to kill you, rise up and kill him first. So for the most part, the common law and American law recognizes what they call the castle doctrine, that you can defend your home. And some jurisdictions, now most famously Florida, have a stand your ground law where you need not back down from any confrontation. And of course you need not always kill the intruder. The Gemara continues, the Pasuk says, Ein lo damin im zorcha Hashem eshalov, v'chi Hashem eshalov v'lvad zorcha, the sun shine only on him. And the Gemara explains, El imbor locha adover kashemesh, she'ein lo shalom imcha hargehu, v'imlav al targehu. If you know as clear as the sun shines that his intentions are ill, then kill him. But if not, you can't kill him. The Gemara has another version that reverses the default position, but the point is the same. You can't kill him if it's clear he doesn't intend any bodily harm. Or for that matter, the person can thwart Bob Machteres or Rodef by disabling him, Achas Meivorov, by disabling him through injuring him. You shoot him in the hand or the leg instead of the head, then you have to just injure him and you cannot kill him. That's probably be an issue in the Zimmerman case in Florida. Did he have to kill him, or was there some way to preempt the harm short of killing him? But since self-defense, that is to say the right to protect your life from the grievous assault of another, is a fundamental to Torah, after all, we want to live. This is the world of Torah mitzvahs. Then the Torah must permit Jews the means to defend themselves and to protect these rights. So I think when the Pasuk says, Chagor charbecha al yareich, hodcha v'adarecha, that's what it's referring to. Weapons become an adornment to a person, to a gibor, a glory and majesty, because those are the Torah's means of a person protecting his life. Interestingly, this includes women too. Although males are naturally protective of women, some normative halacha is that weapons are male appurtenances, but halacha does not deprive women of the right of self-defense, and this has certainly become true in our day. Rav Moshe was asked, can a woman in Gush Etzion carry handguns for self-defense when she leaves the yeshuv? So Rav Moshe writes, came from his grandson, all the question, lives there. Rav Moshe writes in Arachaim Chaylet Gal at Simon Ayin Hay, Avo be'etzem ladina pashut, it's obvious ladin, shebe mekoma shekarv la ha'araviyim, harotzchim, any place that's near the Arab murderers, she'ein yirei me'hamem sholah, k'maisim b'chol yom, then, as we see every day, they're not afraid of the government at all, mutaras ha'noshim lisa klezayin, women are permitted to carry weapons, lo rak l'hatzalah me'hariga mamish, not just to protect themselves from actual murder, from being killed, ela afalhi natzel me'akos ba'almo, even to protect themselves from being stoned, or other types of harm, she'b'mechomos k'tanos elu ha'nimtos ha'noshim k'anoshim be'hechay, then in these mini wars, the women are the same as the men, they're also targets. Shalachain lo shaya chilik ben gavri l'neshev machasrichim likach l'notzel. Here is no difference between men and women, but they need to protect themselves. Yesh likach masha yosir odif lozeh. They can take whatever they need to protect themselves and use it. Rav Avadja is a similar tshuva, nechavadas chelakei simon nunhei. So according to the Torah, weapons are not limited to soldiers or to armies, but are the critical means for a person to exercise the fundamental and internationally recognized right of self-defense. The police are great, kol hakavod, but the police primarily investigate crimes. The police do not usually prevent crimes. They'll find out who did it, they'll put a yellow tape around the crime scene. They'll try to arrest the perpetrators, bring them to justice, but the police are generally, ordinarily, unable to prevent the crime from happening. Only the individual can do that. Well, as we know, during the exile, that aspect of life too often evaporated from the Jewish personality. We were forced to rely on the authorities for our protection, precisely because the authorities in many countries prohibited Jews from owning weapons. A society in which the individual is not allowed to own a weapon for his own defense is a society in which the individual will be at the mercy of criminals and tyrants. So this does not mean that the Torah endorses guns for everyone. You have to be prudent also. So the Mechaber says in Yeradeh, Kufnun Aleph Sif Beis, Ein Mokrim Lahen V'lo Yisrael Choshulim Kor Lahem. You can't sell to non-Jews or Jews who would sell to them. V'lo Yisrael Listim, nor the Jewish robbers. Dover Sheyesh Bo Nezek L'Rabim, something that harms the multitude. Keep going. Dubin V'Arayos, you can't sell them bears or lions. V'lo Shum Klei Zayin, nor any weapon. V'lo Sada, nor stocks. In other words, some control is reasonable. Controls that would ban sales of weapons to felons or other dangerous people are warranted on that basis. Or to we have the halacha not to sell to a violent army or government. And like any dangerous object, like a wild dog, it must be maintained safely. But we don't say that because a person can fall off a roof, so we build a makkah, we don't say don't make roofs. We have to make roofs. You can even use a roof. You have to take the proper precautions, and that becomes a Torah obligation as well. The person should, anytime there's a dangerous object in a person's possession, to take care of it. We should never lose sight of the ultimate goal, the objective, historic objective, when weapons will be unnecessary. So that ideal is actually reflected in halacha. The Chabad brings down our Chaim Kufnun Aleph Sif Vav, that one cannot enter a shul b'sakin aroch, carrying a long uncovered knife or gun for that matter. L'fisha beit, or Mishnah Berurah says, L'fisha beit ha'knesset shemiyuchu l'tfilo ma'areches yom ha'shel adam. The shul, a place of davening, prolongs people's lives. V'sakin mikatser yemei adam. And knives, other weapons, shorten people's lives. But that's also subject to the limitation of reality. So in Chavadas, Chacham Avadja says, Chelekei Siman Yudches. Question was, what should a soldier do with his gun? Nachon v'rotzli me'od shechayal nechnas leves ha'knesses l'spalel yichases nishakot tachas begadot. It's right and proper that a soldier comes to daven, he should hide his weapon, to sidearm for sure, under his garment. V'lo yere achutzo, so it's not seen when he's davening. Then iyashava l'chaso, so if he can't cover it, if you go to rove v'chadome, it's a rifle, a machine gun. V'yesh sorech sheyiso neshako imo beglal sibo bitchonis v'kayotzei bozeh. And there's a reason why he should actually bear it, carry it, for security reasons. Yesh lo ker v'kaneisim anesha gaveis ha'knesis l'tilo. So then we're lenient and we permit him to enter shul with his gun. That's yichavadas. The Tzitz Eliezer, the exact same tshuva in Chelek Yud Siman Yud Ches. And of course we stand down when appropriate. It doesn't mean because we support the right of gun ownership, we just kill people anytime we have the right to do it. You see, for example, David HaMelech had the right and the opportunity to kill Shaul HaMelech twice. But he refrained and he was praised for it. The basic tenet that we apply here is, as always, v'chai bohem v'lo sheyomus bohem. The Torah gives us a system by which we live, not to die. And chayecha kod b'machai chavercha, our life takes precedence over someone else's life, certainly when another person is threatening our lives. So the Torah promotes the right of self-defense. It's reasonable, therefore, that anything that impedes that right contradicts the Torah, and anything that enhances that right accords with the Torah. As in many cases, our fellow Jews are completely off base in their endorsement of strict gun control, you know, the reform movement, which, as you all know, characterizes the Democratic Party with holidays. The reform movement and the ADL are on record very strongly in favor of gun control and against any private ownership of guns. There's an organization that, in fact, came to Shul a year or two ago to speak that goes back to 1989 called the Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, JPFO.org. They opposed the ADL vehemently. In essence, and this is also an important point, weapons are morally neutral, even though you wouldn't know it reading about it. They're morally neutral. And who but the Ramban makes this point in Bereishis, the very beginning, when Lamech defends his killing of Cain to his wives, the Ramban comments on his defense, and he says, Ramban writes at the end, Vein acherev gorem hartzicha. It's not the sword that kills, nor is it the guns that kill. It's the people kill. Ve'ein al ha'oso chet, Ramban says. A person who makes a sword is no sin at all. It's not the sword, it's the person. In a perfect world, weapons would not be necessary. In a slightly imperfect world, the authorities will be able to protect all the citizens all the time. But in the real world we live in, neither is feasible, and whatever increases our security promotes safety and life itself, and that's the Torah. I thank you all very much for coming.